that song always needed a good huh. You'd think Nile Rodgers could have figured that out for David Bowie, but no. Welcome to the Paul Harris Show on the Friday afternoon that gets you rolling towards your weekend here on the Big 550 KTRS. Max is here in the studio with me, and it's time for us to do our showbiz stuff where we review the new movies that are hitting the screens in our town this weekend and get into a bunch of other showbiz news. Before we get into this week's movies, I have to tell you, Max and I will not be here next week. We're taking Friday off, and Max is going to use that day, he told me, to go to a double feature of the new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi. And I said, what do you mean you're going to see that and then some other movie? No. He's planning already on going to see it twice, back to back. Will you even leave the theater and go back later that evening? Or?
No. I'm seeing the noon showing and then the 3 o'clock showing. And this is supposed to be the longest Star Wars movie ever. So even with the 20 minutes of previews, I'm not going to have a whole lot of turnaround time. I mean, enough time to hit the restroom, grab a refill on the popcorn, because you can get a special Last Jedi tin, you see.
Of course.
That you can get the refill of the popcorn and then go back in and see it again.
Wow. I saw a commercial for it last night. I'm not nearly as into Star Wars as you are. I think some of the movies are fine.
Sure.
Some of them are terrible. But I saw a commercial for The Last Jedi last night, and I noticed at the end, and I'm curious if you have noticed this as well. You know, at the end, they put up the MPAA rating, PG-13, and then next to it, there's always that little box that explains how they came to that.
Is this one space violence?
It says, rated PG-13 for scenes of science fiction, action, and violence. How many people are there in the world who don't know to expect that when they go to a Star Wars movie? Science fiction, action, and violence. Ooh.
Oh, there's lightsabers. Ooh.
I don't know why they fit, but that's the way the MPAA is. Oh, God. All right, let's talk about this week's movies. There are two of them opening in our town, and one of them is an interesting movie called The Disaster Artist. I know nothing about this movie except that it is supposedly about the man who made the worst movie ever. Now, before you start talking about it, many, many years ago, Johnny Depp starred in a movie called Ed Wood, which was made by
Tim Burton.
And I'm not a huge Tim Burton fan. I've liked a few of his things, and Ed Wood was one of them, done in black and white, about a real-life Hollywood director who did make some of the worst movies ever, including the one that, in my estimation, is the worst movie ever, called Plan 9 from Outer Space, a movie in which Bela Lugosi, the star, who was played by Martin Landau in Ed Wood, for which he won an Oscar, yes, he died halfway through the production, and that didn't stop Ed Wood from going on and making the movie. That's not quite the same as Ridley Scott replacing Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer in his movie that's coming out in a week. But Plan 9 from Outer Space, to me, still resides in the worst movie ever made pantheon. But you tell me that there's another one that rivals it, and that's what this movie is about.
Yes, it's about the making of that film. That film is called The Room, not Room with Brie Larson. That's a very different movie that, of course, won her Best Actress.
Yes.
It's called The Room, and this has become a cult classic within the last 10 or so years. People always love to talk about the best worst movies of all time. There was a great documentary called Best Worst Movie that's about Troll 2, which I highly recommend. The documentary is great.
I did not know there was a sequel to the marvelous Troll 1.
Well, and it's even funnier because it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be its own movie called Goblin, but then somebody else got the rights and said, no, let's call it Troll 2, so it makes no sense. There are no trolls in Troll 2.
Perfect.
But Troll 2 is a great movie, and that documentary, Best Worst Movie, is great. The entire career of Mystery Science Theater and those riffing type shows like Riff Tracks are based on bad movies like Mano's Hand of Fate and Plan 9 from Outer Space. So I think The Room is definitely a great addition to that list of really bad movies. People have asked me, is it the worst movie you've ever seen? No, I've seen a movie called Roller Gator that might be even worse.
I saw Robert De Niro in The Comedian.
Right, exactly. But what is spectacular about The Room, if someone has tried to make it through, it's kind of an endurance test, is how fabulously inept it is at everything. It's not just that it has an incomprehensible script and dialogue that doesn't go anywhere, plot threads are introduced and and ignored. In the very next scene, characters come and go with no kind of, but the human interaction on film makes no sense either. It's very much like a space alien came down to Earth and said, here's what I think humans are like. And that's why The Room, it became.
Wow. That really sounds horrible.
It really is horrible. And, so I first heard about this, like so many other people, because of actress Kristen Bell. Kristen Bell is kind of responsible for everybody knowing The Room and knowing its filmmaker slash creator, Tommy Wiseau, who is like this 8 foot tall vampire looking person with a very strange accent, and nobody knows anything about his background. He's sort of like a filmmaking Banksy. And what happened was Kristen Bell saw this movie and thought, this is fabulously bad. This is back in 2003, 2004. She started having house parties where she would have her actor friends over. She would show them this movie. Paul Rudd watched it then, Seth Rogen. And she was filming Veronica Mars at the time, which was her claim to fame. Mm-hmm. And she started sneaking in references to The Room in that show. That's how big of a fan she was.
Wow.
And then, you know, Entertainment Weekly was doing stories on it, and then eventually Tommy started taking the film to midnight movies, and back in 2012 it came here for the first time at the Tivoli for one of their midnight movies, and Tommy showed up, and his partner in crime is a guy named Greg Sestero, who is an actor. He was one of the actors in The Room. He started writing a book about the whole behind the scenes process called The Disaster Artist, and that is what this movie is based on. I didn't realize, Paul, until after the movie was over, that it was directed by James Franco. I didn't even realize that, because it's nowhere in the ad campaign. It's just that, I mean, we know that he's playing Tommy, and he does a wonderful job. As a matter of fact, I do think he might be nominated for an Oscar. I know that's strange for a comedy.
That's strange for James Franco.
Well, but he was nominated for 127 Hours.
Oh, that's
so
right.
The Academy has shown him some love,
yep.
And he not only gets the accent down and the mannerisms, but if you've met Tommy in person, as many people have at midnight showings, or if you just Google him or YouTube him, it's a dead-on impression. And it's never a caricature, though. He makes you feel for this wannabe filmmaker. I'm really happy that you mentioned Ed Wood. I think it's probably Tim Burton's best movie. And what Tim Burton nailed with Ed Wood was that he didn't want to be a bad filmmaker. He really wanted to be a great filmmaker.
Yeah.
He was trying
really hard. He just wasn't good at it.
Thank you. And that is the exact same as this movie, where you're rooting for Tommy Wiseau to make a better movie than he eventually does, because he desperately wants to be a great actor. He wants to write a script that has the power of Tennessee Williams, and he wants to make some gut-wrenching drama. And when he finally gets it all together and screens it, people start making fun of it and laughing at it.
Wow.
So he very quickly goes, yes, this is what I meant. I meant it to be a comedy. Ah,
uh-huh.
I'm in on the joke, which is not really what happened.
Right.
But throughout the whole movie, you're really rooting for him. And of course, you know how it turns out if you're a fan of The Room. If you're not a fan of The Room, if you've never seen it, that's okay. You don't have to find a streaming link. You don't have to borrow the DVD from a friend of a friend, which is what I did. You don't have to see it. You wouldn't have had to have seen Plan 9 from Outer Space to really get into the drama of Ed Wood.
Now, let me just jump in here and ask you this. Ed Wood didn't just make Plan 9 from Outer Space the worst movie ever. He made about a dozen movies.
Mm-hmm.
He got financing from other people and made these movies, none of which were as incompetent as what it seems like you're describing to me here.
No.
Did Tommy Wiseau ever do anything after The Room?
Well, it's funny that you bring that up. Ed Wood was able to make lots of different movies because he turned them in fast, he turned them in cheap, and the people always got paid. Much is unknown about Tommy Wiseau, where he's from. He won't tell anybody. He says he's from New Orleans, but that accent is not New Orleans. How old he is, nobody knows. He makes jokes that he's a vampire. I halfway believe him. He also self-financed this movie for millions of dollars. Where did you get that money, Tommy? He's not telling. So he hasn't done anything else since then. He's basically been traveling with this as a roadshow and making money with appearances.
So he's famous for exactly one thing.
He is, and I don't know if he'll ever make a sequel or a follow-up. My concern would be he would try to capture lightning in a bottle again and do, you know, okay, now I'm in on the joke. Here's a really bad movie on purpose, and that's not going to work.
But it's not lightning. It's a faint spark.
Well, the reason why The Room works is because it is so earnest. It was trying hard to be a really good movie like Ed Wood, and it simply wasn't. But if you're a fan of The Room, you'll love this movie. It's a great behind-the-scenes look at a very strange person. But if you've not seen The Room, I would still recommend it as a movie about filmmaking and a movie about friendship. James Franco's younger brother, Dave, Dave Franco plays Greg Sestero, and his real-life wife, Allison Brie, is also in the movie. You've got a pretty great cast here. Sharon Stone shows up, and Seth Rogen is in there. And the very first face you see talking about The Room is Kristen Bell. And what a great thing that they did, putting her in there.
Nice. You know, yeah. Very nice. Okay, a scale of 0 to 10.
I would give this movie an 8. I think for what it's doing, which is telling this very particular story, I think it does a great job. And Franco does a great job as director.
The Disaster Artist, playing in art houses.
Yes, it will. It's playing at Frontenac and Tivoli. Now, if this gets good buzz, I could see it going wide. But I think that not too many people have actually seen The Room, so people don't know what this is.
I mean, yeah, even if it does get a good buzz, there aren't going to be any screens to show it after Star Wars comes out next week.
Oh, does Star Wars come out next week?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right, so 8 out of 10 from Max for...
I liked it.
The Disaster Artist. The other movie that's opening in St. Louis today is called The... Not The, just... Darkest Hour. That's the title. And it was originally scheduled to open next week until somebody said, wait a second, you're opening a movie against Star Wars? You better change that. Mm-hmm. Then they looked at today and you're only opening up a movie against The Disaster Artist?
Right.
Okay. You got a much better chance. Darkest Hour is the third movie this year whose plot centers on the British Army being trapped on the beaches of Dunkirk by the Nazis in 1940. The first one was a light drama slash comedy called Their Finest, which I liked a lot.
And the other one was Baywatch.
No.
Oh, wait.
Okay. By the way, if you haven't seen Their Finest, it's out on DVD now. It stars Gemma Atherton and Bill Nye, one of my favorite English actors. Pretty good. Not great, but I think I gave it a 7 or 7.5 when it came out earlier this year. Their Finest is what it's called. The second movie was Dunkirk, which was Christopher Nolan's epic, which was told by... Well, it was told from three different perspectives in three different timelines. And you need to know that before you go see the movie. There are three simultaneously occurring different timelines.
I really didn't like that movie.
I know you didn't. I liked it a lot more than you did. Won't be on my best of the year list, but it was a good movie. And now we get the third of the year about that topic. It's called Darkest Hour. And it stars Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill in his earliest days as British Prime Minister. Now, we have seen Churchill portrayed on screen many times before. Most recently, John Lithgow and Brendan Gleeson both have won Emmys playing him on TV shows in the last decade. John Lithgow did it in The Crown on Netflix. But this is the best of the lot of the Churchill performances. The makeup on Gary Oldman is astounding. It is said that he had to sit there for 3 or 4 hours at a time, and over the course of filming, 200 hours in the makeup chair to take him from looking like Gary Oldman to looking like Winston Churchill, which is not just putting on a fat suit.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike Woody Harrelson's makeup for LBJ,
which was atrocious.
Horrible. Google that, and you will laugh out loud when you see the pictures of it. When you look at still photos of Gary Oldman or moving pictures of him in this movie of Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, it's a remarkable transformation. And Oldman is such a great actor that he not only looks like Churchill, but he sounds like him and he acts like him. He is sure to be nominated for a Best Actor. In fact, I would have to guess that he's the guy to beat.
He's going to win, yeah.
He's way, way ahead of the rest of the field for Best Actor for the Oscars, which haven't even been announced. The nominees haven't even come out yet. But I'm just telling you right now, he will be on that list and be the guy to meet. So the plot of the movie. After the disastrous reign of Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister of England, Winston Churchill was chosen to lead the country at a perilous time. The Germans had rolled through most of Europe with not very much resistance and had trapped virtually the entire English army on these beaches at Dunkirk in France. Once they were wiped out, it would not be long before the Nazis crossed the English Channel and attacked Britain. And with no military left to take them on, that would have been the end of England. The Nazis would effectively have owned all of Europe, and then you're not too far away from the man in the high castle. The Netflix series, was it Netflix or Amazon series?
Amazon
series. But that didn't happen, of course. We know from history. There were some in the government of England who were urging Churchill, when he became prime minister, to still try some sort of backdoor negotiations with Hitler through Mussolini, the dictator of Italy, who was part of the Axis with Hitler. But Churchill abhorred that idea, understood that surrender could not be an option. And so this movie portrays Churchill's meetings with Parliament and with his war council and with King George VI during those difficult days. Unlike the action-heavy Dunkirk, this movie is very talky, but it's never slow. We see Churchill portrayed not as a perfect man. There's no doubt this guy drank too much and smoked too many cigars and was never really in good health. But he was a statesman. The kind of statesman you don't really see all that much in the 21st century. He was a statesman who had to try to figure out how to lead his country and inspire its citizenry. Darkest Hour is directed by Joe Wright. I don't know much of his history. What else has he done, Max?
He did Atonement and Pride and Prejudice and Hannah. He's a fabulous filmmaker.
Okay. He has a keen eye for the subterranean corridors of power that Churchill has to navigate. And also gives us some pretty nice scenes of Churchill at home with his wife, Clementine, who's played by Kristin Scott Thomas. It's an underused role, the wife of the powerful man, but she's very good in it. And we also see him having meetings at Buckingham Palace with the king, who is played by My Mississippi Grind co-star Ben Mendelsohn, and is very, very good in that role. The king has his advisors telling him to leave the island, rule in absentia, because the Nazis are coming and you'll be captured and killed. So that's all worked into the plot here. It's not just meetings with the war council. The biggest flaw in this is a scene towards the end in which Churchill rides the subway with common Brits in order to get their feelings on what he should do about the Nazis. It never happened. And I don't like when you take real history and stick in something that didn't happen just to prop up your story and lead it to a better ending. It didn't need that. It's a good scene. It makes for some solid comedy and interesting moments with Churchill and regular English people. But the screenwriter, Anthony McCartan, and the director, Joe Wright, just invented the whole thing. It's a shame because I think they get the rest of the Churchill story right. Nonetheless, you should see Darkest Hour, primarily because of Gary Oldman's work in the role, but also because it's yet another part of the world history that we don't know enough about. I'm giving The Darkest Hour an 8 out of 10.
Fantastic. Two eights today.
Now, let's talk about Gary Oldman for just a second. Here's a guy who's had an interesting career. He has done some very good work in things like the Batman movies, Batman Begins and Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, where he played Jim Gordon, who eventually became Commissioner Gordon.
Yep.
He was Harrison Ford's nemesis in Air Force One. Get off my plane. He was in a terrific movie with Joan Allen called The Contender, where he was the villain, a senator who was trying to keep her from becoming vice president. He played Lee Harvey Oswald in Oliver Stone's JFK. He played Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy. He was Sirius Black in the Harry Potter movies. He was in an underseen movie called Murder in the First. That's all in the plus column for Gary Oldman. The rest of this, now I know a guy's got to work. If you're an actor, you got to take jobs acting. He was in one of the movies we hated the most this year, Max, The Hitman's Bodyguard.
Yes, he was. I don't know why.
I don't either.
I really don't. I mean, it was a bad part.
Bad part, bad movie.
Yeah.
It's out now on DVD and Blu-ray.
But you shouldn't watch
it. Do not get it.
That's bad.
No. He was in another horrible movie called Criminal with Kevin Costner, which both of those are going to be on my worst movies of the year list. Horrible. He was in the RoboCop reboot. And worst of all, and this is one I bet he wishes he could erase from IMDb and Wikipedia and his resume forever, he was in the Lost in Space movie.
Oh, that's right. He was the science officer guy, right?
Why is somebody of Gary Oldman's talent, a guy who we're going to see probably win an Oscar for this role, doing Drek like that? I understand that you got to take a paycheck.
Maybe he loved that show.
No, I don't think so.
Also, two other roles that he was phenomenal in. He played Beethoven in a film called Immortal Beloved that is just extraordinary.
Yeah, you don't know it.
For someone to play Sid Vicious and Beethoven, that's kind of amazing.
That's a range.
And also, one of the best Draculas of all time, Bram Stoker's Dracula. He was Vlad Dracul.
Oh, I forgot about that.
He's phenomenal in that.
Very, very good. Darkest Hour is his new one, and he is phenomenal in this. We'll take a break and come back with more of the Showbiz Show right here, right after this on the Big 550 KTRS. Talking showbiz stuff as we do every Friday at this time. I am Paul Harris. Max Boise is here in the studio with me. And I got a letter, an email from a listener in Antioch, California, who listens to our podcast and listens on the KTRS app as well. Smitty wrote to say, "Hey, Paul, love the show. I have a question that maybe you could include in your showbiz show. When a movie makes $100 million, that's how much was sold in tickets to the theater, right? But who gets that money? I can't imagine the theaters do. Do they get a cut, or do they just make their money off of the concession sales? And what about the distributors? How do they get paid? In other words, who gets that $100 million, and who gets what piece? Do you know, Max, how it's broken out? I know a little bit about this, but not all the details."
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no simple, short, and concise answer to this. This is something called a recoupment waterfall, and every investor could have different terms. So really, the breakdown could be different for every single movie. Sometimes a major star can demand a percentage of the gross income. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes the film's budget may have been provided by tax rebates, so that splits it up differently as well. If a movie makes, let's say, you know,
$100 million.
Yeah, well, based on the graph I have right here, you spend $30 million to make a feature film. It grosses $75 million. What happens with that? Well, first of all, you have to pay the distribution fees. You have to...
marketing costs?
Yeah, marketing costs, the sales agent, the minus your original budget. You could only have about $3 million left, so the producer's pool gets about $1.5 million, and investor's profit gets about $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's different for every single film. Now, some of that goes back to the theater chains. He was asking in the letter, I can't imagine the theater gets a lot of that. Well, no, they don't, but they are effectively renting these movies. So they're paying into how Star Wars and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's different for...
Okay,
for
here now, to add to that, here's what I know. The movie theaters don't get much of a percentage at the first few weeks of any big movie. You know, for instance, when Star Wars comes out and makes whatever it is, or Thor, or Justice League, or Wonder Woman, I'm thinking of the biggest hits of the year, those movies that make over $100 million in their first weekend, the theater gets very, very, I mean, we're talking single percentage points of that, and it doesn't go to that theater, it goes to the theater chain.
Exactly, yes.
You know, AMC, Landmark, Cinemark, Marcus / Werenberg, depending on where you are in the country, that's who gets, but a very, very, very small percentage of that. So yes, in effect, when you're buying your stuff at the snack bar, that's where they make their money.
Absolutely.
And you'll notice that that's where the prices are jacked up, because that's essentially all they're going to make money from. That's why small popcorn costs $6 and a small soda costs $5 or more than that.
And I don't mind paying that, because I'm happy that they're showing the movie I want to go see.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're going to shut down if you don't buy their popcorn.
Now, the other part of that, where you talked about the profit participants, mm-hmm. They are often subject to a little thing called Hollywood accounting, which is sometimes movies can make $500 million, but according to Hollywood accounting, they still haven't made a profit.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference between getting gross points and net points. If you have gross points, let's say you have 1% of a movie that makes $500 million around the world. Well, what's 1% of that? That's $5 million. That's the kind of deal that Jack Nicholson had when he played the Joker in Tim Burton's first Batman movie.
Yep.
Gross profit participation points. Then there are the people who are getting just profit participation, where they're getting net. And that is after everything gets written off, and they will think of everything they possibly can. Lunch, the caterers, all that sort of stuff. Everything gets written mm-hmm. off there.
Yep.
The meetings the executives had to go to. Every single thing. Just like somebody trying to finagle their tax return so they have as many write-offs as possible. The people who make these movies and the studios that make them, they want to write off as much as they possibly can, because otherwise they got to give it back to the people who were involved in making the movie, the producers, etc., the money people.
And if Disney has a big box office bomb like John Carter, mm-hmm. they actually write that off.
Yes. $70 million write-off for John Carter against something that was a big success.
Mm-hmm.
And so it goes on and on and on. The answer is not a simple one,
no.
Tom. And, you know.
And it can be different for every film.
It's a great question.
Yes.
We're not in the movie business, but I can tell you, you should be glad you're not in the movie business, because the business is usually not all that great for people. You see those, you know, when a movie wins Best Picture, It's not the director or the stars who go up there and make that speech. It's the executive producers of the movie. They're the ones who, in some cases, put up their money, but really their job was to get other people to put up their money and to convince the studio then to buy the distribution rights for it, for a small movie that maybe because they saw it at Sundance or the Toronto Film Festival or at South by Southwest or any place else where festivals are. They want these independent studios like A24 and others to pick it up and pay the distribution rights. And once they've done that, and then it's gotten word of mouth and sold a lot of tickets, when they can get up there and claim the Best Picture Oscar, like last year, not the La La Land producers, but the Moonlight producers, right. When they went up there, that was not just a sigh of relief that, hey, we made a movie that won the Best Picture Oscar. That was, hey, because we won Best Picture, we're going to have a chance of making a little bit of money back here.
Yeah, exactly. People will go watch Moonlight now when maybe they wouldn't have.
Yeah, which I think was a mistake. But nonetheless, that's a great question, Smitty, and I appreciate you writing to us and listening to us all the way in Antioch, California. Now, last week on this show, we spent a few minutes talking about Olaf's Frozen Adventure.
That's right.
Which is the short that Pixar was showing before Coco. It's 21 minutes long, and Max explained last week on this show that it was originally designed to be a TV half hour.
That's right. It was going to be a Frozen holiday special like Rudolph or Frosty the Snowman.
Run on ABC or the Disney Channel or one of the ABC television networks. 21, 22 minutes of content. The rest would be commercials. Perfect. But they didn't do that. They decided to put it out there as a short in front of Coco. And as I mentioned last week, that was annoying to a lot of people.
It's 22 minutes.
Because you take your kid to go see Coco at 7 o'clock at night. You got to sit through 20 minutes of trailers and commercials. And then you got to sit through a 21-minute short. The sugar is starting to wear off on the kid at that point before Coco has even kicked in. And a lot of parents were upset about that. Well, as of today, that's no longer a problem. Last night, in most theaters around the country, was the last time that the theaters were being forced to show that before Coco. Here's my question. Is there another Pixar short that they're slipping in there? I don't think so, because if they had one, they probably would have done that.
I can only imagine that some executive might be packing his bags before Christmas, because this was a bad choice to say, let's put this in front of Coco.
Now, here's why it was a bad choice. 21 minutes. Let's say you have 4 showings a day of Coco. That means 84 extra minutes of the day were taken up showing Olaf's Frozen Adventure. Instead of those 84 minutes going to that, you could have shown Coco one more time and gotten extra admissions, extra tickets sold, which would all go through that Hollywood accounting we were just talking about. But still, you've got a hit movie in Coco. You want to get it out there and have people see it as often as you possibly can.
And you don't want people to be talking about the annoying short in front of Coco,
right,
which has been dominating the news instead of Coco.
Right, but getting that extra play in for Coco would have brought them more money and effective today. And I think it'll get a lot more people going to it over the course of the next few weeks, because the word of mouth on Coco is fantastic.
And I bet when Coco is released on Blu-ray next year, the Olaf's Frozen Adventure will not be a special feature on that Blu-ray. They'll probably repackage it with an extra special Frozen, you know, movie before Frozen 2 comes out, because they are making Frozen 2 as we speak.
Of course they are.
Of course they are.
Of course they are. All right. Speaking of Disney-related stuff, Pixar is part of Disney. Disney is still in the hunt for Fox content, because Rupert Murdoch has announced that he's going to hold Fox News Channel, he's going to hold Fox Sports, he's going to hold the Wall Street Journal and their print enterprises, but he wants to sell off effectively 21st Century Fox as a TV and movie studio. And they're back to talking about this. We talked about this 3 weeks ago on this show when it looked like it was a done deal. Then it wasn't a done deal. And other people like Verizon and Comcast and some others started getting involved. And they were in the running, too. Apparently now they've been pushed aside. And the reason for all this, Max, is?
I mean, well, Disney's just trying to become the biggest conglomerate on the planet, I think.
Netflix.
Really?
they want to go up against Netflix. They're going to have their own streaming channel starting in 2019.
That's right.
When you have a streaming channel, you need content. And while Disney and Pixar and Star Wars and the Marvel stuff is all under the Disney logo.
ABC and Muppets.
All of that stuff is Disney content. That's still not enough. You need more. And 21st Century Fox has been producing not just movies, but decades of television.
Well, and they also, from the geek point of view, they also then get the rights back for different superhero franchises like the X-Men, which has been, I think, 10 movies now, including Logan that came out this year, and the Fantastic Four and all of those characters as well. So it actually makes their superhero division even larger.
All right. Speaking of streaming stuff, I've got a recommendation for you for a new streaming show that's been out for a week or so that my wife and I binged last weekend. I'll tell you about that, and we'll get to more showbiz stuff in just a moment here on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS, Paul Harris, Max Boise, talking show business stuff. There's a new show that is streaming on Amazon Prime that's actually not new if you ever watched Amazon Pilots last year. The way Amazon does it is they produce a pilot episode and then they put it out there and let people vote on the pilots that they like. One that they showed last year was called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which enough people, myself included, liked that they decided to take it to series. And so now they have the first season, which is all 8 episodes, and they're all available for you to binge, as we did last Sunday, on Amazon Prime. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is about a woman named Midge, who's a housewife in the late 50s, who's married to a guy named Joel. Joel seems like a pretty successful businessman. At night, he likes to go to a nightclub and try his hand at breaking into stand-up comedy. But she finds out in the first episode that he's not actually that funny when he's doing his own material, and he's also not that funny when he's doing another comedian's material. I won't spoil it for you, but he's not doing his own stuff. He's basically doing bits that he's heard on records. And at the same time, Midge finds out that Joel has been sleeping with his secretary. And this leads them not only to a breakup, but she has a few too many drinks one night and goes down to that same nightclub and bursts out on stage and goes into this hysterical and somewhat profane rant that ends with her ripping open her blouse and showing her breasts. Well, in the late 50s, that was enough to get you hauled off to jail, Lenny Bruce style. And that's just the beginning of the adventure for this character, who decides, after some support from Susie, a woman who works at that club and kind of manages it and helps the comedians and other performers get their parts on stage right, she decides that she's going to try to do this and try to be a stand-up comedian. At the same time, she's broken up with her husband. She has to find a job. She's got two kids she's got to take care of. She's got to deal with her parents and her in-laws, all of whom are a huge part of her life. The fathers are played by two actors you know. Her father's played by Tony Shalhoub. His father's played by Kevin Pollak. They're both terrific, as are the women playing their wives, whose names you would not know. Rachel Brosnahan plays Midge, the central character in this, and she's very, very good. And also Alex Borstein is the name of the woman who plays Susie. She's also very, very good. Both of these are going to be up for Golden Globes and other TV awards coming up in this awards season.
Alex Borstein voices Lois on Family Guy.
Okay, there you go. The show is from Amy Sherman Palladino, who is probably best known for Gilmore Girls. Her husband also writes and directs on this show. It's 8 episodes. It's on Amazon Prime now. It's called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I really enjoyed everything about it. My wife and I binge-watched the whole season last Sunday. You could easily do it this weekend.
I can't wait to watch it. It's been on my to-watch list for a while now. I love Amy Sherman Palladino's shows, everything from Gilmore Girls to Bunhead. She's really talented, and I'm happy this one got a whole season in order.
Now, speaking of streaming shows, what do you think of House of Cards coming back for 8 more episodes without Kevin Spacey and with Robin Wright as Claire Underwood as the star of the show?
You know, it feels like the right thing to do, and I'm happy that everyone else who worked on that show, all the behind the scenes people, still have a job, that they were not, you know, they didn't lose because of Kevin Spacey's actions. So yep. I think it was the right thing to do.
Okay. I think so too. I've watched the show the last season or two had not been all that great, but this is one of those shows where I said from the beginning, I'm committed to watching every episode of this. And now I wonder what they're going to do. Does the Frank Underwood character get killed off?
Does Robin Wright actually kill him? I mean, we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. All you know is you're not going to be seeing Kevin Spacey at all.
We do know that they had weeks of filming already done. Is any of that usable? I mean, will he appear in the show at all?
Who knows? Maybe Robin Wright goes off and marries Christopher Plummer. We'll have to wait to see.
I like it.
And then the last thing I've got to ask you, Max, is last night I was playing poker and the TV was on and we had the football game on. Yeah. And they made a big deal about showing a special preview from Jurassic Park, Fallen Kingdom.
Yes.
With Christopher Pratt and Chris Pratt.
Yeah, Chris Pratt.
And Jessica Chastain. Nope. And of course.
Nope. Bryce Dallas Howard. It's the other redhead.
That's who that is.
Yeah, it's the other redhead.
Because I was going to be really upset that Jessica Chastain, who I like a lot, was doing this dreck.
No, it's Bryce Dallas
Howard. Bryce Dallas Howard, okay. Yes. And Jeff Goldblum is in there as well.
For a cameo.
Here's my question. The movie looks like yet more people who decide we're going to toy with science and then have to fight off these animals that want to eat them.
So inexplicably, Jurassic World, which came out 2 years ago, was one of Universal Pictures' biggest moneymakers that summer. I don't know why. I don't think it was a good film at all. And of course, I love the first Jurassic Park. It's a great movie. Spielberg did an incredible job.
But all the sequels have sucked.
Yes. And so Jurassic World was just a dreadful film. It made all the money. And so now we have a sequel called Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And the plot of this one, Paul, is you had this theme park, this Jurassic World, if you will.
Yes.
But wouldn't you know, there's now an active volcano there. Whoops. I guess we should have planned for that. And now the volcano is going to kill all these dinosaurs. We have to go rescue the dinosaurs. How about, no, we don't. They shouldn't exist anyway. You should just modify
their organisms.
Make more. You can make more. You don't have to save these. So they go back to the island that is now a fallen kingdom with lava everywhere.
Have the people in the Jurassic Park movies not seen the stories about the other people who went to the Jurassic Park island? I'm not talking about having seen the movies.
Right.
But wouldn't you have heard of what happened with everybody since Richard Attenborough who went to play with the dinosaurs?
You know, it's very strange because Jurassic Park was, hey, we're going to open this one day. Wait a minute, dinosaurs. And then The Lost World was, oh, they migrated to another island. Okay, dinosaurs. And then the third one was, now there's a plane crash. We have to go to save people. Jurassic World, the big change was, it was an active theme park. And kids were there and people were there, and then with this one all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, there's a volcano and they're all gonna die. It makes no sense. It just, and the trailer looks horrible. And I like Bryce Dallas Howard, but it looks so bad.
I like all those people we talked about, even the ones I got wrong.
She's in Black Mirror, by the way. She's in
which is coming out, I think, in the next week or two.
Yeah, I need to watch
the new season. I'm looking forward to that big time. If you have Netflix and you haven't watched that yet, Black Mirror. Don't go see the Jurassic Park movie. Binge watch that instead. That's all the showbiz stuff we have for you this week. Next hour, it's the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News. This is the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS.